offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it is my pleasure to join you, as always, from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. Our apologies for the delayed start. We had the celebrations in the Mandir. The Shivratri celebrations started officially today with the dance program by the Prashanthi Dance Group, and that's the reason why our evening broadcast of the Thursday Live was delayed, and the Bhajan Twitter file was a little longer than usual. So because of all of that, we are starting about 25 minutes late, but hopefully we will cover whatever I had intended to cover on this episode. So let's begin, as always, with a short summary of what we've been doing so far. We are in the fifth chapter. We could say that we are in the second half of the fifth chapter. We covered three verses last time, and hopefully we'll be able to cover three more this week, but we'll see how it goes, maybe two or three. We covered verses 14, 15, and 16 of the fifth chapter last time. Before we came to that, Krishna was speaking about the jnani. The whole subject of all of these shlokas is the jnani, the man or woman of wisdom, and how that person goes about the characteristic of that person. As I said, there are different ways by which the nature of a person of wisdom is being described in different chapters, and that continues here. And the backdrop of that is sannyasa or renunciation, right? But of course, these verses that we are going through, the ones which we went through last week and this week, are not purely on renunciation, but it is a continuation of that discussion. So Krishna has been speaking about the jnani, and who is a person, after acquiring the wisdom, lives like a king in a city with nine entrances, right? That's the beautiful allegory that was given. And the city with nine entrances, of course, is the human body. In the 14th verse that we went through last week, Krishna continues from that point and somewhat blurs the line between the self and God purposely by using the word Prabhu, which means a master, which is also used for God. So it could be a reference to the master that he was speaking of as the king of the city. At the same time, it is also a direct reference to God himself, because he says, the Lord neither creates action or doership, nor is he the dispenser of consequences for the actions that are performed. So that was what he said in the 14th verse. And in the 15th verse, Krishna says that as the Atma neither acts nor does it force to act, no sin or merit can be attributed to the Atma or the Self. We saw how this is so, though we always say that everything happens because of the Lord, who is the Self within each one of us. The Atman or the Self does not have any role to play in the nature of the action that is being performed. Yes, everything that we do is being powered by this Atma within, because if the Atma is not within, then this body is as good as dead. But at the same time, the Atma does not choose the nature of actions. So there is no involvement in what would otherwise be labeled as sin or merit, what would otherwise be called as an act that needs to be rewarded, an act that needs to be punished. That is why you cannot attribute sin or merit to the Atman. And it does not create actions. And karmani is the word which was used, and we spoke of how grammatically it means not only action, but objects that are a result of action as well. We, of course, in the process of all of this, discussed about the most important critical question of who is deluded. If I am the Atma that is perfect, then who is deluded and who has to be enlightened? I will not go into the depths of that discussion that we did last time, but that was a discussion that we had, and I think I had even a couple of people writing back saying that that was helpful. So those of you interested could go back to that episode and listen to that. In the verse number 16, Krishna says that in the case of those whose illusion has been destroyed by the self-knowledge, for them, that knowledge itself illumines itself like the sun. Well, in the 15th, he said that the ajnana cover the jnana, and that is what causes the problem. And it is almost spoken of as jnana does not have any proactiveness to reveal itself. It is just there. If it is covered by ajnana, it is covered by ajnana. It does not bother itself too much to tear itself outside. But here in this verse, it is saying that the jnana kills the ajnana almost in that vein. And we spoke of how this shloka refers to the jnana and ajnana in the mind. Jnana and ajnana can be spoken of as the nature of the self and the nature of prakriti. Nature of the self is wisdom. Nature of prakriti or maya is ajnana. But here what is being referred to is the jnana and the ajnana in the mind. The ajnana in the mind is that I am separate from the rest. The jnana in the mind is the understanding that I am not this body and the self, and the self is the same in everyone. So with that jnana, the ajnana is destroyed, and when that happens, the jnana from within, which is the nature of the self, reveals itself like the sun. The light of the sun is what aids us to see the sun. In the same manner, it is the illumination of the jnana which helps us see the jnana itself. So those were the verses that we covered last time. Verses 14, 15 and 16. We will go to the next few verses. This is verse number 17. We will listen to it in Brother Shyam's voice. I'll give you a brief meaning of the shloka and then we will discuss in detail about it.
Tadbuddhayastadatmanah tannishthastatparayanah gacchantyapunaravrittim jnana nirdhuta kalmashah.
Those who have their intellect absorbed in that, whose self is that, who are steadfast in that, who have that as their supreme goal, they attain the state of non-returning, their dirt having been removed by knowledge. So that's verse number 17, and as it is obvious, the word that repeats again and again. It's almost like an alliteration. Krishna ended the last shloka by saying, Jnanam prakashayati tatparam. Jnana reveals that, right? Tat param means that supreme. This shloka is about that, which is being referred to as tat in Sanskrit. And very often the Supreme Brahman is referred to with this word tat in Vedanta and in all of these, because it doesn't say he or she, talk about gender parity. So the word tat is used, which means that. Because the most famous usage of that is being in the Mahavakya, tat tvam asi. You are that, or thou art that. So after saying that tat will be revealed, he describes the relationship between the jnani and that tat. Technically speaking, most of this is again superfluous, like every other description of a jnani, because the moment you say that the jnani does not have the illusion that he is this small self, he is identified with the self which is the entire universe, I think all other description and explanations is superfluous. But as always, there is enough for us in this shloka to learn from. And even though these statements are mere repetitions of the obvious, we will see that the way it is worded, the way it is sequenced, does give us an opportunity to learn and think more deeply on some of these concepts, which will be very helpful for us. So Krishna elaborates the nature of a jnani and says, Tat buddhayah, whose buddhi is turned to the tat, or the self. Another way of translating it is, one whose buddhi, or intellect, is awakened to that tat. This is actually a more apt and appropriate way of translating that statement, and we'll see why it is so. And then he goes on to say, Tadatmanah, for whom that tat has become one's own self, tannishtaha, who is established in that tat, tat parayanaha. For him, that tat is the ultimate aim. Jnana nirduta kalmashaha. Those whose sins have been washed away by jnana, gacchanti, goes to apunaravrittim, the state from where there is no return. So wherever I say tat, it means the self, it means the Atman, it means the Brahman, right? So in case you are not able to follow, so whenever I say tat, whenever there is a reference to tat in all of these shlokas, it means the self. Most of these statements are those that have been mentioned already, as I just said, but they are conveying something very beautiful in the way they are presented to us in the shloka. First Krishna says, tat buddhayaha, those whose intellect is awakened to tat, or that, awakened to the Brahman. Swami would say this particular thing in his discourse, and I must have quoted this when we were speaking about decision making and how to control the mind and the senses. I think it comes somewhere in the third chapter. Swami says, the senses are subtler than the body, the mind is subtler than the senses, and the buddhi is subtler than the mind. The subtlest is the Atma. But between this buddhi and Atma comes the Ahankara. Right? This is something that Swami says. If I'm not wrong, there is one particular discourse about the buddhi in the 1990 Samukho series where Swami makes this statement. What is this buddhi? Swami says it is called Nischayatmika buddhi, which means that the buddhi has the decision-making capacity. Nischayatmika buddhi. It is the discerning buddhi or the decision-making buddhi. For anything in life, I must know what is good and what is bad, what is acceptable and what is not. Right from what I eat to what I wear to how I speak to everything. Right? There's always a what is acceptable, what is not acceptable, what is right, what is wrong. A lot of people ask this question that we keep saying Advaita is about going beyond dualities. So there is no good and bad. So why do we have to judge? It's not so. This discrimination cannot be given up till we become a jnani, and we will see that even in the other shloka that we probably will be going through if we have time. So why do we have to judge? Like what Krishna explains in this verse, that discrimination must depend on something, right? When he says tat buddhayaha, there is a lot of importance which is given to this buddhi or intellect aspect in spirituality. So that discrimination should be based on something, right? Even for worldly discrimination, it should be based on something. There should be some criteria or some basis for that discrimination. For example, I'm eating food. On what basis do I decide what food is good and what is bad? If I only go by what tastes good to my tongue, I'm going to ruin my health, right? There is no secret in that. So the health of the body becomes the criteria on the basis of which I must discriminate what is good and what is bad. Of course, the taste may be a secondary consideration, but the primary consideration must be the health of the body. Similarly, almost all the decisions that we make is based on something. There must be some criteria on which we decide what is good and bad. Now, let us talk about the various other decisions we make. Just for example, most of the time our decisions are based on self-benefit, what Swami would refer to as swartham and swaprayojanam. How will it benefit me? But certainly there is selflessness also in this, right? I'm not saying that all of us our decision making is based merely on selfishness and self-interest. We do, to a lot of extent or to a great extent, make decisions on the basis of selflessness too. Let me explain that. You know, one of the scenes that I was seeing in the past few days is that we've been having a monkey menace in the ashram, right in front of the shopping complex. A huge army of monkeys are jumping all over the place. And I think even now, if you come there in the mornings, you will see that plenty of monkeys running all over the place. And devotees were coming out of the shopping complex. They grab fruits and eatables from them. And they're jumping all over the place. A lot of confusion happening. When you think of the scene, you know, you're walking out of the shopping complex with a bag of apples or oranges, and these monkeys pounce on you and they grab the bag from you and go. Come to think of it, from the monkey's point of view, what the monkey is doing is absolutely right. You have something in your hand that the monkey needs. The monkey takes it from you. If you cannot defend yourself, it's just too bad for yourself, right? That's the point of view of the monkey. But the same thing, if another person does that in society, not a monkey, but a person does that in society, we consider the person to be a thief. We consider that behavior as unacceptable in society. Why? Because I think we have an inbuilt nature into our society, into our understanding of how we lead our life in society, a means by which we protect the rights of each other. I don't snatch from you because I know the pain if someone snatches from me. I don't want to hurt you because I don't like it when others hurt me. So if I were to think only about me, in other words, if my discrimination of what I do is only based on me and myself, that becomes an animal existence, isn't it? That becomes a monkey behavior. When I slowly expand my thinking and now my discrimination is based on not just what is good for me, but what is good for, say, a few others too, like my family, and from there to my community, and from there expanding to, say, my nation and eventually the whole earth, I am tending towards a human behavior. When I start considering the pain and the needs and the suffering of another person, and I do not want to be a cause of that. That is why this attitude of Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, the whole world is one family, it is my family, Swami says this is the basis of human values itself. That expansion love, Swami would say, is his human value. But still, this buddhi will always be influenced by a certain amount of selfishness. Why? Because as Swami says, this ahankara always clouds this buddhi as long as it is there. So till we have this body consciousness, our discrimination will be affected at least to a certain extent by that. Swami would say, when we are not threatened, when our self-interest is not in danger, our discrimination will be intact. We will discriminate well and behave ourselves. But the moment we are put in a situation where me and mine are likely to be harmed, the way my buddhi will work will completely change. And you see this even in some of the advanced societies. As long as all citizens in the country are well provided for, the compassion and love in the name of civility of that society will be very high. But when there is a semblance of a crisis, you will see that people start becoming very selfish and people start caring more about themselves. And of course, in the same situation, you also see some people exhibit enormous amounts of selflessness too. And in fact, that is what sets apart those people from the rest of us, isn't it? Those are the people who are more evolved, and those are the people who are able to see the expansion as their own self. That's a different point, but the point I'm trying to make here is, as long as we have the ego, as long as we have body consciousness, the discrimination will be colored by that ego, right? Isn't that? It's a very practical thing. This is not something that is beyond our grasp or beyond our understanding. As long as I think I am this body, somebody else becomes my family, somebody else becomes my children, somebody else becomes relatives, just like how it's happened to Arjuna. And your discrimination starts getting contorted. And that is why you would see many people who do wrong things, they almost get into the mode where they convince themselves that what they're doing is right, because they're helpless. They can't do anything. What other thing they can do? They have to fend for their family. They have to provide for those who are dependent on them. Swami would say this, that when your when your self-interest comes into the picture, your discrimination or buddhi starts getting distorted, because the ahankara is subtler than the buddhi, and the ahankara forms a film or a layer of dust on the mirror, something like that, on the buddhi. Be that as it may, another important place where discrimination comes into play is where the idea of purpose comes into play. Let's say I have a chair in front of me. There is a certain buddhi that is involved in the usage of that chair. Something I can do with it, something I can't do with it. What is that based on? It is based on the purpose of that chair, isn't it? When I know that this object is so that I can sit on it, sitting becomes the right thing to do. Probably standing on it and jumping on it becomes the wrong thing to do. So using it for what it is meant for is the right thing to do. Using it for something that will make it unusable for what it is meant for becomes the wrong thing to do. So now when I look at my human life, if I have the wrong notion that this life is only to glorify this body and keep giving it pleasure, then doing what gives me pleasure is right, and anything that will give me pain is wrong. Anything that helps me and my family lead a luxurious life becomes right. Anything that denies me that luxury becomes wrong. So now my buddhi will work on the basis of my understanding of purpose too, isn't it? But when I am aware of the Brahman, when I am aware that my goal is that, this life is meant to break free of this bondage, then what is right and wrong in life will completely change. Going back to the example of the chair, I think it is a chair, but someone comes and tells me, no, no, it's not any ordinary chair, it is a chair that Swami had sat on. So we use it to worship and we keep it for bhajans and things like that. Now sitting on the chair becomes a wrong act, isn't it? That becomes an unacceptable act. So with an understanding of the purpose of an object, purpose of an entity, the discrimination of the buddhi with regards to that entity also changes. In the same way, when I am sensitized to what is the purpose of this human life, the way I will use my buddhi, the way I will discriminate will change. So more or less, this is the first step in spirituality, to be aware of what is the purpose of this life, of this human birth, of this human body. Tat buddhayaha. Hence is when the buddhi is awakened to that tat, awakened to that Brahman. Till now my buddhi was only acknowledging the world, so I use my intellect to fare better in the world, to grab better in the world. But when I am made aware of the Brahman, the way I lead my life changes, or at least it must change. But merely being told or informed about the Brahman might not be good enough. That is why Krishna says, Tadatmanaha tannishtaha tatparayanaha. I must then acknowledge that the Brahman is my true self. Tadatmanaha. That tat is me, is myself. I am that. As we just saw, when I think that I am this body, my discrimination will be different. But when I start thinking that I am that Brahman, my discrimination is going to be different. With that will also come the feeling that I am this Brahman, and the same self is in everyone. So the selfishness in my discrimination will slowly and surely wither away, isn't it? And that will be mentioned in the shloka, in the next shloka as well. But we'll come to that shortly. So, tat buddhayaha tadatmanaha. My buddhi is aware of that Brahman, and I am also aware that myself is that Brahman. Tat buddhayaha tadatmanaha. Tat parayanaha means to know that Brahman is the goal. Tat is the goal. And when I am aware of that being the purpose of this life, again the way I discriminate will change. Most importantly, this is not a pastime. Right now, for most of us, this is still one of the pursuits. This has not yet become the pursuit in life, at least for me, right? If there are some sincere sadhakas there, this might not apply to you. We are now worldly people using spirituality to add probably a bit of taste and garnish to our lives. This should become the sole purpose of our life. Then we can progress towards the state of tannishtaha, those who are established in that Brahman. And in a way, if you see, this is the one word, tannishtaha, that distinguishes the person described here as a jnani. Because as a sadhaka, we all can and should have tadbuddhayaha, be awakened to that tadbuddhayaha, tadatmanaha, tatparayanaha. But when we are established in that Brahman, only then we become tannishtaha and can be called a jnani. We can have our buddhis awakened to that tat. We can have a sense or an understanding or the information that that tat is myself. We can also have that tat as our goal. But as long as we are a tannishtha, we are not yet a jnani. But as we can see, merely the buddhi being awakened to that Brahma can and should change our lives. Practically speaking, the most important change is we must become fearless in goodness. I might lose $1 million speaking the truth, but I will not be bothered about that. I might harm myself, rather I might harm my body and my possessions by being righteous, but I will fearlessly follow righteousness. Because now I know I am not this body, and I know that my goal is not merely to pamper this body. That is what tadbuddhayaha really means, to be awakened to that Brahman as me and as my goal. So if you ask me, all this is fine, how will I know if I am absorbing what the Gita is saying? I will say, I would check myself this way. Am I becoming more fearless in doing the right thing? Am I able to think less of myself as this body? Am I able to treat lightly the losses of mere possessions? So these are the ways by which you know whether our understanding is growing in the path, understanding is growing in the wisdom. Going back to the shloka, as I said, this is about a jnani, tannishtaha, one who is established in that tat. Krishna says, such a person, gacchanti apunaravrittim. Avrittim means to come or to enter. Punaravrittim means coming again. So this is a reference to rebirth. Punaravrittim means we keep coming again and again. Apunaravrittim means the state from where there is no returning. Right? So gacchanti apunaravrittim, a person who is a tadbuddhayaha, tadatmanaha, tannishtaha, tatparayanaha, reaches that state from where there is no return. How? Jnana nirdhuta kalmashaha. Because their kalmashaha, their flaws or impurities have been destroyed by this jnana. What are those flaws? Raga and dvesha, ahankara and mamakara. As I said right in the beginning, nothing that is said in the shloka has not been told by Krishna already. Right? Even in the few chapters that we have gone through, we have already heard all of this. But the way it is said, the way the words are used, the way they are all put together, it gives us a little more insight into what has already been said and what we can internalize in what has already been said. So that is the 17th verse of the 5th chapter. We'll listen to the next verse. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss about that.
Vidya Vinaya Sampanne Brahmane Gavihastini Shuni Chaivashvapakecha Pandita Samadarshinaha.
The learned ones look with equanimity on a Brahmana endowed with learning and humility, a cow, an elephant, and even a dog, as well as an eater of dog's meat. So that's the 18th verse. Quite an interesting collection of individuals there. As I completed the description of the previous shloka, all this philosophy is fine, but how must it translate in my life, right? That's a question that always bothers us. And if it does not bother us, it should be bothering us. We should be asking that question. How do I translate this into my everyday living? The answer to that is not very simple. But one of those answers is presented in this particular shloka. For now, the bottom line of wisdom or the standout trait of a jnani is he or she sees one's true self as Brahman and that there is nothing else other than this Brahman, right? That is the one line by which you can describe a jnani. So the obvious result of that is an equal vision. You don't see someone as beautiful and someone as ugly. You don't see someone as being great and someone as being insignificant. When I have reached the state where I see beyond the physical, then there is no way I can discriminate on the basis of these traits, isn't it? So in this verse, Krishna says just that. He says, Panditaha Samadarshinaha, a truly learned and wise person, Panditaha, is a Samadarshinaha, who sees everything and everybody with an equal vision. And then he gives a small list, which is certainly not exhaustive, but it gives an idea. He says, Vidya Vinaya Sampanne Brahmane. Towards a Brahmin who is endowed with Vidya and Vinaya, education and humility. Gavi, on a cow. Hastini, on an elephant. Shunicha Eva Shvapakecha. Shuni means dog. And Shvapaka means those who eat dogs, and which was a term which was used to be used in those days for outcasts, right? So Shunicha Eva Shvapakecha, towards dogs as well as those who eat dogs' meat. So Panditaha Samadarshinaha, be it a learned and humble Brahmin, be it a cow, elephant, dog or a dog eater, Gavi, Hastini, Shunicha, Eva, Shvapakecha, a cow, elephant, dog or a dog eater, Panditaha Samadarshinaha, a jnani sees them all as equal. And why does he see them all as equal? Because they are in reality to him the Atman. And the Atman is not the doer, nor does it inspire to do. Na kurvanna na karyanna. So it is neither the sinner nor the meritorious one. So there is no difference between a pious, vegetarian and an uncultured forest dweller or a murderer or a thief or a king or a simpleton, right? So there is no difference because from the point of view of a jnani, he or she does not look at the physical anymore. Till now, Krishna, whenever he spoke about the jnani, it was for two purposes. One, those traits which are being described of a jnani can be practiced as part of our sadhana, right? That's one of the things, as we said, even when he is describing a jnani, he is actually giving tips to the karma yogi when we were going through the chapters on karma yoga. Right. Similarly, when he was talking about the importance of action, he spoke about jnani, how he goes about doing his action. In the same way, whenever Krishna describes jnani, one of the purposes is so that we can absorb those traits by practicing them, and by practicing them, you kind of try and achieve that state. And the other purpose why he would describe jnani is so we know what to look forward to. So when you say that he is equanimous, or when you say that he has infinite patience, those are all, as I said, I think last week or the week before that, these all become like the milestones that we look forward to in the spiritual path. In that sense, this samadrishti or samadarshinaha, he says, is a trait that is more of a mental attitude than a physical practice. A lot of people, as I said just a couple of minutes ago, tend to embrace this as a physical practice, and there are enormous dangers in that. please don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there must be discrimination and people must be discriminated against. But the point I'm making is a very simplistic approach to this concept of samadrishti could be very dangerous. And Swami would often say this, and he would put it in a very simple statement. He would say, yes, there is no distinction. Yes, everybody is one and the same, but you cannot treat your mother and your wife the same way, can you? Right? As simple as that. Swami would say, yes, everybody is one, but you must know to whom to behave in a certain manner, to whom you have to speak respectfully, to whom you can speak like a friend. And that's why Swami would say, everybody is same, but your mother should be treated like a mother, your wife should be treated like your wife, right? As simple as that, because that is the practical aspect of life. And what Krishna has been saying about karma, that also applies here, if you really look at it in that manner. Krishna had said, for a jnani, acting and non-acting is the same. But still a jnani chooses to act, because he said, others will follow what a jnani does. So he might as well do righteous deeds, the correct actions or his duties, so that the person who is still in the state where he needs to do karma, he will look at the jnani and perform the karma, right? In the same manner, from the jnani's wisdom, because the jnani sees only the atma and does not see the physical, there is no duality, there is no different. But the others still need to discriminate between what is right and wrong actions. So when a jnani sees a Brahmin, he does not see the knowledge or the meritorious actions because they do not in any way add to the atma. Similarly, when he sees a murderer, he might not see the sin because in no way the sin forms a blemish on the atma. But if the murderer is to come to the state of a jnani, if that jnani wants to bring that murderer to that state in which he or she is in, then firstly, that murderer probably has to give up the sinful deeds, right? Has to stop committing murder and take up dharmic actions. That is why this idea of equal vision is the ultimate state of spirituality, and this is the very essence of non-dualism, of Advaita. Unless the mind is prepared to receive this truth, it can mess up with the mind completely. And all through when we speak of Karma Yoga, we've been emphasizing how all Karma Yoga leads to Chitta Shuddhi, right? And that way the mind is prepared for this wisdom and non-dualism, right? That's what we've been telling. Chitta Shuddhi or Antakarna Shuddhi is what is the goal of a Karma Yogi. And then the mind is prepared for that. And we went through those verses where Krishna says, and shortly thereafter, jnana just springs up, and shortly thereafter, the ultimate peace is attained. So the jnani has obtained that jnana or that state through the process of purification of the mind. And to appreciate this wisdom of non-dualism in its ultimate form, there is no good or bad, there is no right or wrong, there is no sin or merit. For that, the mind has to be prepared. And you will find a lot of people who take to the learning of Vedanta pouncing to this idea right away, saying that, oh, there is nothing good and bad, there's no right and wrong, right? Especially, if you're very young and if you've not read the right kind of literature and you read this, it will completely mess with your mind, right? Because on one hand, we are giving so much importance to discrimination, right? That's why buddhi is given such an important part. Swami would say, buddhi is closest to the Atman. And in the human life, it's all about enabling that buddhi to rule our life. Buddhi to be inspired by the Atman and buddhi to rule our life, which means discriminating right and wrong is a very, very essential part of spiritual life. So that being on one side, on the other side, we are saying there is no right and wrong. We are saying that a Brahmin who is a Vidya Vinaya Sampanna, right? We are not describing merely a Brahmin, we are describing a very good person. We are describing a person who has dedicated his or her life to learning and who is humble in that learning. So we are describing a very good person. And when we say a dog eater, it is not a reference to any caste or any community. It is a reference to somebody who does not discriminate. He says, whatever I get in front of me, I'll eat. Today there is a vegetable, I'll eat that. Tomorrow if there's a dog in front of me, I'll eat that. There's no discrimination right there. So this is like two ends of the spectrum. And that's why when Adishankara gives a commentary for this. He actually says that, you know, these are the two ends of the spectrum where the Brahmin is being described as one who is filled with sattva-guna. The animals that are mentioned are those that are filled with tamo-guna. So they are two extremes of this creation. And for the jnani, they're all equal, right? So that is the state the jnani reaches eventually. So you're taking the highest form of Advaita and you're placing it in a mind where that mind requires discrimination. That mind should think what is right and wrong. What can I eat? What can I not eat? What can I say? What can I not say? What is the right thing to do? What is the wrong thing that I must avoid doing? When that is the need for that mind, if you give it this concept of Advaita, it is very dangerous. It can only lead to adharma. It can only lead to sin. That is why the mind has to be prepared by karma yoga. The mind has to be prepared with dharma. Swami would say this any number of times. The best way to purify the mind is to do righteous deeds. And then you're prepared to receive this. Right? So that is why I said this is not everyone is prepared for this. I'm not saying that I am prepared. I'm not saying that somebody else is prepared. But we must, for a certain point, live with both truths, if I could put it that way. Yes, everything is one. Yes, I need to discriminate. Probably rationally and with proper explanation, I might not be able to say that these two are, this is how they are connected, right? I may be able to say it or I may not be able to say it. You may be able to say it. You may not. But if you're not able to, I think till the time when we are able to reconcile with both, we probably have to live with two truths, right? It seems like hypocrisy, but I think that is a wise thing to do. Right? That is why Bhagavad Gita is so very special. It speaks about right action. It speaks about dharma. It is speaking about, the whole thing is about Krishna telling Arjuna what is the right thing to do. But at the same time, it speaks of the highest truth. The same Krishna is saying that a jnani does not see any difference, right? So this is the 18th verse. I think we'll just go to the next verse. Probably we'll have a brief discussion on that, and then we'll conclude this week's episode. This is verse number 19 from the 15th chapter.
Ihaivatairjitas sargo yesham samye sthitham manaha nirdosham hi samam brahma tasmat brahmanite sthitah.
Even here on earth, they conquered the creation, those whose mind is established in equality. The equal Brahman is faultless. They live in the Brahman. So that's verse number 19. The whole problem of delusion is that we associate the self with the body, right? That is the root of all problems. And Arjuna is upset because he thinks that he's the body. He thinks that all those in front of him are the bodies and that his body is in some way related to those bodies. And that's the root cause of all the pain. And that's the root cause of every one of our pains and every one of our happiness and joys, everything together, right? That illusion is that we associate this body with the self. If I think that, you know, every other attribute, if you just make a list of things that make you happy and make things that make you proud, if I think I'm fat or short, if I think I'm a very eloquent person, or if I think I'm an idiot, if I think I'm rich, if I think I'm poor, it is all born of association, associating this idea of myself with the material world. Either this material body or the material possessions of this material body. And it is this association that is completely snapped in a jnani. And with that, all the defects and merits also fade away. That is why when a jnani sees a Brahmin or a dog eater, it is the same, because the Atma is untouched by what is eaten. Can we say that the Atma is the dog eater? We can't say that. Can we say that the Atma has memorized the Vedas? That is also wrong. Right? So that is why the jnani, when he looks at both of them, he does not see the body, he does not see the possessions of the body, he does not see the lineage of the body. He does not see the pedigree of that person. He sees the Atman, which is the reality. And when that happens, that is release. That is liberation. That is why Krishna says, Yesham samanye sthitam manaha, whose mind is firmly established in that equal vision, iha eva taihi jitaha sargaha. Here itself, they win over sargaha, means samsara or birth and death. There are two important points that are being made here. One is that one is liberated here itself. Even as one is living, one attains that ultimate. That is one of the important points that Krishna makes here. And the other is what I said during the last verse. Yesham samanye sthitam manaha. Those for whom there is equality in the mind, in perception, in conviction, they believe that all are one. But still, they will continue to respect, say, the age of the person. They will treat a person according to one's gender. But in their mind, there is not a spot of doubt that whatever be the appearance, whatever be the possessions, whatever be the nature of the physical body, the reality of that person standing in front of me is Atma, the self, the same self which is in me. So the jnani will see that one's self and the other person's self is one and the same, but will not go and sit in that person's house and say, see, the self in the Atma in me is the same as the Atma in you, so this house belongs to me. If a jnani comes and does that to your house, will that be acceptable to us? No, a jnani or an enlightened person would never do that, right? So there is a line which even a jnani does not cross. And as I said, it might well be described as a behavior that is suitable to show as an example for those who have not yet reached that state, right? So it is, as Swami would say, there should be bhava advaitam. The feeling of non-duality must be in the form of a feeling, right? Feeling of non-duality is a bhavam. Bhava advaitam is important. Vishaya advaitam is nonsensical, right? Swami would say it is stupid. You cannot eat fecal matter. You will have to eat food which is acceptable. Even if you become a jnani, you'll only be called a mad person if you do that. Similarly, even if you become a jnani, you'll still wear your footwear in your foot and you will not carry it around in your hand, right? So that discrimination continues effortlessly, as we have been saying so many. Dharma becomes effortless in a jnani, but in the mind, samye sthitam manaha, the mind is ever steady in the fact that there is no two. There is no, that person in front of me is not distinct from me. In the next line of the shloka, Krishna states again, why do they see such equality? Nirdosham, spotless, he indeed, samam brahma. Nirdosham hi samam brahma. Spotless indeed is the equal Brahman. Meaning, the Brahman is equally spotless in a humble Brahmin or in a mindless animal. Tasmad brahmani te sthitaha. So the jnani is ever established in that Brahman. He or she doesn't see the doshas, but only sees the Atma, which is nirdosha. And because of this trait, they become a samadarshina. They see everything is equal, and because they see everything is equal, they are released from this sargaha, this samsara, or this life of birth and death, even as they live. That is the shloka that is being said here. So this is a very, very important concept to understand, that yes, there is equality, but at the same time, there should be discrimination too. And that's why these two shlokas start with that phrase which Krishna uses, tat buddhayaha. What happens when the discrimination is illumined, or the discrimination is awakened to the awareness of the Brahman, right? Buddhi is given primary importance in Vedanta, primary importance in Swami's discourses and Swami's teachings, because that discrimination is very, very important. But at the same time, the state that is reached is the state where you do not relate to any of these ups and downs, right? you could hold that as your, what I would say is, you know, the ultimate goal that you want to reach, right? That state of non-duality is the ultimate state I want to reach. That could be my goal, but at present, as I always think of it, imagine I'm walking towards the Empire State Building and my goal is to reach the last floor in the Empire State Building. Even if I want to reach there, I can keep that in my mind that that is where I want to reach. But every step that I take, I'll have to look down and see if there is a pit, if there is something there, if I'm banging into someone, am I crossing the road, is there any vehicle coming? I cannot give up that discrimination that is required in the very step that I'm taking, right? So in that same way, this samadrishti can be the ultimate goal which is kept in the mind, saying that this is the aim of my life. That tomorrow nothing should matter to me. Pain and pleasure should be one and the same. Loss and benefit should be one and the same. But in the present, we discriminate between what is right and wrong, what has to be done and what should not be done, right? That is never given up. So with that, dear listeners, I'll probably conclude this week's episode. We'll continue with this chapter next week. Thank you for joining me. Tomorrow we are having the Shivratri celebration, so advanced Shivratri greetings to all of you. Swami would say we are all laboring endlessly to rein this mind, right? So to say, we are trying to purify this mind, we are trying to control this mind and offer it to God. Swami would say the Shivratri is one of those beautiful occasions that we get every year in which the mind is susceptible, really, in that sense. It gives itself to be turned towards God, and that is why Swami would say that Shivratri and the Akhanda Bhajan that we have here is so that the mind can be got a little more under control during some of these special occasions. So with that, dear listeners, I'll take you leave. I'll join you all again next week for the resumption of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live. Till I meet you all next week, take care. Jai Sai Ram.